It is a commonplace of all religious thought, even the most primitive, that the man seeking visions and insight must go apart from his fellows and live for a time in the wilderness. If he is of the proper sort, he will return with a message. It may not be a message from the God he set out to seek, but even if he has failed in that particular, he will have had a vision or seen a marvel, and these are always worth listening to, thinking about. Let it be understood that I am not the sort of man to whom it is entrusted direct knowledge of great events or prophecies. A naturalist, however, spends much of his life alone, and my life is no exception. Even in New York City, there are patches of wilderness, and a man by himself is bound to undergo certain experiences falling into the class of which I speak. I set mine down, therefore. A matter of pigeons, a flight of chemicals, and a judgment of birds, in the hope that they will come to the eye of those who have retained a true taste for the marvelous, and who are capable of discerning in the flow of ordinary events the point at which the mundane world gives way to quite another dimension. I have said that I saw a judgment upon life, and that it was not passed by men. Those who stare at birds in cages, or who test minds by their closeness to our own, may not care for it. It comes from far away out of the past, in a place of pouring waters and green leaves. I shall never see an episode like it again, if I live to be 100. Nor do I think that one man in a million has ever seen it, because man is an intruder into such silences. The light must be right, and the observer must remain unseen. No man sets up such an experiment. What he sees by chance. You may put it that I had come over a mountain, that I had slogged through fern and pine needles for half a long day, and that on the edge of a little glade, with one long, crooked branch extending across it, I had sat down to rest with my back against a stump. Through accident, I was concealed from the glade, although I could see it into it perfectly. The sun was warm there, and the murmurs of forest life blurred softly away into my sleep. When I awoke, dimly aware of some commotion and outcry in the clearing, the light was slanting down through the pines in such a way that the glade was lit like some vast cathedral. I could see the dust motes of wood pollen in a long shaft of light, and there on the extended branch sat an enormous raven with a red and squirming nestling in his beak. The sound that awoke me was the outraged cries of the nestling's parents, who flew helplessly in circles about the clearing. The sleek black monster was indifferent to them. He gulped, wetted his beak on the dead branch a moment, and sat still. Up to that point, the little tragedy had followed the usual pattern. But suddenly, out of all that area of woodland, a soft sound of complaint began to rise. Into the glade fluttered small birds of half a dozen varieties, drawn by the anguished outcries of tiny parents. No one dared to attack the raven, but they cried there in some instinctive common misery, the bereaved and the unbereaved. The glade filled with their soft rustling and their cries. They fluttered as though to point their wings at the murderer. There was a dim, intangible ethic he had violated, that they knew. He was a bird of death. And he, the murderer, the black bird at the heart of life, sat on there, glistening in the common light, formidable, unmoving, unperturbed, untouchable. The sighing died. It was then I saw the judgment. It was the judgment of life against death. I will never see it again so forcefully presented. I will never hear it again in notes so tragically prolonged. For in the midst of protest, they forgot the violence. There, in that clearing, the crystal note of a song sparrow lifted hesitantly in the hush. And finally, after painful fluttering, another took the song, and then another. The song passing from one bird to another, doubtfully at first, as though some evil thing were being slowly forgotten, till suddenly they took heart and sang from many throats, joyously together, as birds are known to sing. They sang because life is sweet and sunlight beautiful. They sang under the brooding shadow of the raven. In simple truth, they had forgotten the raven, for they were the singers of life and not of death. I was not of that airy company. My limbs were the heavy limbs of an earthbound creature who could climb mountains, even the mountains of the mind, only by a great effort of will. I know I had observed a judgment and observed a marvel, but the mind, which was my human endowment, was sure to question it and to be at me day by day with its heresies, until I grew to doubt the meaning of what I had seen. Eventually darkness and subtleties would bring me round once more. And so it proved until, on the top of a stepladder, I made one more observation upon life. It was cold that autumn evening, and standing under a suburban streetlight in a spate of leaves and beginning snow, I was suddenly conscious of some huge and hairy shadows dancing over the pavement. They seemed attached to an odd globular shape that was magnified above me. There was no mistaking it. I was standing under the shadow of an orb-weaving spider, gigantically projected against the street. She was about her spinning when everything was going underground. Even her cables were magnified upon the sidewalk, and already I was half entangled in the shadows. Good Lord, I thought, she's found herself a kind of minor sun and is going to upset the course of nature. I procured a ladder from my yard, climbed up to inspect the situation. There she was, the universe running down around her, warmly arranged among her guy ropes attached to the lamp supports, a great black and yellow embodiment of the life force, not giving up to either frost or stepladders. She ignored me and went on tightening and improving her web. I stood over her on the ladder, a faint snow touching my cheeks, and surveyed her universe. There were a couple of iridescent green beetle cases turning slowly on a loose strand of web, a fragment of luminescent eye from a moth's wing, and a large, indeterminable object, perhaps a cicada, that had struggled and been wrapped in silk. There were also little bits and slivers, little red and blue flashes from the scales of anonymous wings that had crashed there. Some days, I thought, they will be dull and gray and the shine will be out of them. Then the dew will polish them again and drops hang on the silk until everything is gleaming and turning in the light. It is like a mind, really, where everything changes but remains, and in the end you have these eaten-out bits of experience, like beetle wings. I stood over her a moment longer, comprehending somewhat reluctantly that her adventure against the great blind forces of winter, her seizure of this warming globe of light, would come to nothing. It was hopeless. Nevertheless, it brought the birds back into my mind, and that faraway song which had traveled with growing strength around a forest clearing years ago. A kind of heroism, a world where even a spider refuses to lie down. Refuses to lie down and die if a rope gets still be spun onto a star. It was his dependently dark mood that attracted me. For him, I would make an exception. He alone would accompany me on this solo camping trip. I was lucky that I could take such a trip at this time, as I have discovered there is no faster way to hit bottom, and no more certain way to rediscover rungs of gratitude for the climb back up. A cool pool and a creek well upstream of the last trace of human trail is something to be grateful for. So are pine knots, matches, a tarp, and a flannel lining for the sleeping bag. So too is a low canopy of alder leaves and the delicate weavings of spiders. I knew from the outset that, with the exception of a daily trek to a spring a quarter mile away, I would wander little farther these 4 days than the distance I could throw a stone. I knew I would just sit and look and think and not think. Communing with Lauren would be the Spartan exception. I have darted in and out of his books only for 10 years, and only in the past 2 or 3 have Lauren's stories come to feel like my own. I, too, am the star thrower on the beach, the contemplator of found skulls. I, too, have melted into a watershed and brought home from the field astonishing prizes, only to be even more astonished when the quiescent life bursts into new being. For this trip, I tossed his first book into the pack. Half of the essays had been published in magazines before I was born, and the book itself when I was 5. This was Lauren Isley's The Immense Journey. On this trip, I would learn why it had taken me so long to develop a taste for Isley, and why I needed him now. For years, I thought Annie was enough. I had read that Lauren had been an inspiration for her own writing. She was closer to my age, and her epiphanies along a creek, and the company of frogs and muskrats and monarch butterflies, they were dark enough to suit my own take on evolution. And, of course, she was a sister for a generation of outdoorsy women who thrilled in the opportunities that became widely available to our sex just when we came of age. I could have carried Annie with me, but I chose Lauren. On day 2, I began at the beginning, savoring the first several essays, his descent into the slit that took him a few feet beneath the plains, but many millions of years back in time. His conquest of childhood trauma that heretofore had kept him from surrendering to the flow of water. I had to skip the middle essays. Isley to me is pensive, science-studded reveries emerging from the frame of deeply personal stories. The middle essays are strictly didactic. Isley's literary skills are present, but not his soul. I knew I must find a special time to read The Judgment of the Birds, and that this essay would be the last for this trip. Time came just before dark on my 3rd and final night. Previous nights, I had slept under the tarp, tied between the tree and deadfall beyond the reach of possible flood. There had been rain or the threat of rain. Thankfully, this evening looked promising for a sleep out on the little gravel beach. I wanted to feel protected this night, and only the flames at my feet, the log jam at my head, and the close canopy of alder would do. The reason? I had seen a mountain lion that morning. Rationally, I knew there was nothing to fear. Our 2 biggest predators are hunted for sport in this wilderness. More, lions are not attracted to vegetarian fare. Camp food is not a lure. If the cat decided there was something here worth eating, that something would only be me. And that decision most likely would have been made when we first fixed eyes. But the wilderness and solo camping are not conducive to rational thought. Here, primal ecstasies are paired with primal fears. I knew, too, that it could just as easily not have seen the lion. I would not have seen the lion had I not turned my head at precisely the right moment. Had I not seen the lion, I would not have noticed the spot of mud pressed with two clawless toes on the animal trail that passed by camp. I would once again have slept soundly beneath the tarp, sans fire, sans fear. I would still have read the judgment of the birds that evening, but I might not have engaged in such an intense and prolonged reverie. Early that morning, I had crossed the creek and walked 100 paces to a grassy point discovered the week before on a day hike. At the time of discovery, I vowed to return for an extended visit. The best place to sit and watch the creek below was dolloped with bear shit. Last fall and winter's bear shit, full of juniper seeds. Next to the ponderosa pine was a roundish depression in the duff, I intuited, where the bear had more than once come to sleep. Only an unusual number of ants milling in that spot kept me from curling into sane. Just as I had planned to read Isley on this trip, I planned to contemplate predation on Defecation Point. Into my pack, I had carefully placed the right mandible of a bear. As with a rosary or prayer beads, I could work thumb and fingertips over the rounded canine and flattened molar. Sometimes we read nature writers to enter their world. Sometimes we read them to enhance an appreciation for where we ourselves have ventured, as I was doing on this trip. But there are times when nature contrives to offer up experiences so profound that intrusion by anyone would be travesty. I came upon the bear mandible at just such a time. If this were my only Isley-esque experience, I would not feel shortchanged. It was a few months after my 45th birthday. The approach of menopause could no longer be ignored. I knew I had to come to terms with aging, to let go of youth. But on that trip into the wilderness, I received an even greater gift. I was granted a place to die. If not actually, and at least in my imagination when the moment arrives. This, after all, was where the bear of a particular little canyon had come to die. Right here on a shelf above this slither of water. A shelf I discovered during a solo day. The previous day I had intuited that no bear occupied this valley. My mate and I had come upon bushes of lushly ripe raspberries. In this sparse landscape, the berries would not otherwise have gone uneaten. The disarticulated skeleton was still settled on the shelf, the bones almost in proper order, but the skull and right mandible had fallen into the rivulet, resting atop a tumble of branches and pine needles. Thunder, signaling the first full monsoonal rain, was just beginning to rumble, and the sky was churning clouds. There was nothing to do but enter the darkness, to become the bear and weep, to learn how it feels to be old and mortal. I clutched the mandible to my own jaw and rocked, feeling with hand and heart the years and years of wear. As true as any truth, I knew this animal to have been a she-bear, one who over the course of 17 years had tended every berry bush and climbed every oak in this canyon. Ominous clouds and now winds joined the thunder. There was little time remaining. The catharsis over, I knew the mandible was mine to keep. But I knew, too, that I must do one thing for the bear. I now picked up the skull for the first time, tied one of my own white hairs onto the right orbit, I began to search for an alcove in the canyon wall. I found one, placed the skull with a view upstream, and returned to my pack and poncho just as the storm hit. An hour later, the rain subsided, but the rivulet had become a torrent. All flotsam swept away. 3 years have passed. Rarely have I thought of the bear, and the mandible mostly remains in its claw. But something has shifted. I no longer dream of bears. I no longer dream of bears ripping through cabin walls, claws reaching for the rafter I cling to, or the high cupboard into which I am curled. I used to dream of bears a lot, and the dreams were never pleasant. Was the bear my fear of death? I do know that the experience with the gentle skeleton grounded me to help, to truly help with my mother's death 1 year later. There is no better helper than one who can launch herself into the death project with as much conviction and equanimity as the dying. Could I have done that without the bear? Could I have honored my mother's wish to define and work toward her own vision of an ideal death? It was not my mother's death, nor my own, that I needed to come to terms with this night beneath the alder. Those tasks had been attended to. Rather, it was the death that 34 years had been ever so expertly avoided. A great gaping hole in my memory. A numbing blackness. This was the death of my father. Quickly, I made the calculation. Just as I was a week short of the second anniversary of my mother's death, I was also a week short of attaining the age my father would forever remain. A second revelation followed. Now I knew why I had chosen Lauren as my companion, and why his immense journey. This was the book our minister had given me the day before my father's funeral, the day before my 14th birthday. My sister and I had just completed confirmation classes at our congregational church. I recall Dr. Reed explaining how, like a watch, a creation requires a creator. I was almost convinced that day that believing in God was warranted. An hour must have passed as Betsy and I stood outside the church waiting for Mom to pick us up. A neighbor finally came in her stead, and then the rest is just blank. I do remember Reverend Reed sitting by my bed and offering the little book with its tangerine cover and black-lined fishes. I don't believe I ever opened it. The book I had with me now was blue, a silhouette of a fork-tailed tern at its center. Every hour or so, I added another pine knot to the fire. When the moon finally looked into the canyon, the fuel was gone, and it was time to sleep. Mid-morning, I returned to Defecation Point and began to record my thoughts. I wrote about my original commitment to contemplate predation on this point. I wrote about how the canyon had complied, especially the birds. Two robins, a rufous towhee and a canyon wren, had been scolding a predator as I approached the point the previous day. The target of their protest was with them in an alcove directly across the creek, lost in a jungle of green. I also noticed that something had changed on the point itself. Near the bear shit was a fresh lion scrape, a magnified version of what a house cat will do in a garden. I gathered some palm-sized rocks and reshaped a patch of ground into a comfortable seat, a juniper trunk for my back. I was tense, but the canyon wren occasionally brought a smile. Its nasal alarm call was fitting for the purpose at hand, but periodically some switch flipped in its brain. A lovely descending song, the anthem of southwestern canyons, played instead. That evening I would open the blue cover and read. It was then I saw the judgment. It was the judgment of life against death. I will never see it again so forcefully presented. I will never hear it again in notes so tragically prolonged. For in the midst of protest, they forgot violence. There, in that clearing, the crystal note of a song sparrow lifted hesitantly in the hush. In my case, the protest continued all day. Though after the first hour or so, Only the robin pair maintained the vigil. The penetrating single chirrup was posted incessantly, every few seconds, for hours and hours, even as distant thunder at last drove me back to camp. I have seen a fox curled and restful, even as jays did their best to dislodge the intruder. This predator could indeed have been no more ferocious than a fox, but I had seen a lion. Not long after encountering the scrape and settling into watchful solidarity with the birds, an urge came to look left. There, on the low rim of the opposing cliff, was a great, tawny creature, head down and lost in the grasses. The animal had a remarkable shoulder hump. For some crazy reason, dire wolf was my first thought. I knew it could not be one of the newly reintroduced Mexican gray wolves. Those wolves all wore ghastly orange collars, both for keeping track of their wanderings by radio and to ensure that no gun could mistake one for a coyote. Finally, the creature lifted its head, a head improbably small. Lion. Although the distance was too great and the ridge too shaded for me to make out the eyes, the head was pointed in my direction and remained there for a time I cannot honestly estimate. The next thing I remember is the animal casually resuming its uphill journey, long tail emerging from behind a bush, the end jauntily tipped up. Birds, my mind screamed, birds, wake up! There's a lion over there. That's the animal you ought to be scolding. But no, the staccato protest maintained in the alcove straight ahead. Soon, the most frightening event of the day occurred. A pair of Steller's jays had added their own voices to the din, and now one flew from the jungle to a low branch on my side of the creek, a few paces directly ahead. The jay kept scolding, but here is the horror. The bird's back was to me. The pair of jays tired of the game and flew off, returning briefly much later in the day to lodge one more round of protest. The following morning, while I wrote in my journal, I heard the judgment of the birds once more. This time the judgment was all clear. Silence. How stories burrow into the brain. Reading the bird essay beneath the alder, I was amazed to find within it two other stories that I had assumed were packaged independently, so vivid the images. One was the story of the orb-weaving spider, its gargantuan shadow cast by a streetlight on a cold autumn night. I stood over her a moment longer, Isley had written in the shadow, comprehending somewhat reluctantly that her adventure against the great blind forces of winter, her seizure of this warming globe of light, would come to nothing and was hopeless. Nevertheless, it brought the birds back into my mind, and that faraway song which had traveled with growing strength around a forest clearing years ago. A kind of heroism, a world where even a spider refuses to lie down, refuses to lie down and die if a rope can still be spun onto a star. The evening of the pine knot fire, at dusk and just after closing the immense journey, I moved to a spot on the gravel beach where I had grown accustomed to watching the sky darken. There she was again, amid a particular gape in the alder leaves, reweaving in the evening calm, blotch of strands that the sun-driven breeze had destroyed by day. I knew she was a she. The previous evening, a small spider had pounced upon her in the center of the web, and the two remained locked in unmoving embrace, even as I quit my post. This evening she spun and waited unmolested. The next morning I was curious to see whether my fire had singed any of the low-hanging leaves. This from my journal. The leaves were fine, much to my relief, but there were the black strings of spider webs. everywhere amid the branches over the fire, decorated with ash, sadly useless. Most were the tangled masses and bridges of the long-legged spider variety. But there was also one small orb, gleaming black, black pearls, jeweled in the morning light. And there, too, a few white threads, where one spider or another had begun to rebuild a life.